Hi everyone. Just a reminder that this show is not legal advice, trading advice, financial advice, or personal advice. Enjoy the show and thank you very much. This show is sponsored by Eero. Never think about Wi-Fi again. And by Formosa Financial. Financial services for blockchain innovators. Yo, yo, welcome to Crypto 101, the average consumer's guide to cryptocurrency. This is Matthew Aaron, and today we have on Alex Sterk, community manager of Ubik, and he's here to tell us a 101 on the project. This conversation came from the community again. They put us in touch because they wanted to know more about this project. So thank you very much to the community. Thank you very much to Alex, and I'm very excited to go down the rabbit hole with him about this project. Before we get into this conversation, please go to crypto101podcast.com, join the Facebook page, the Twitter, the Instagram, join the conversation. The market's down. That doesn't mean that we stop learning about crypto and the space and influencing the future. Also, think about becoming a patron. Check out the Patreon page. We have a surprise for everybody who's been a patron for over 6 months. It's our way of saying thank you. Also, subscribe to us on iTunes, CastBox, Pocket Cast, or SoundCloud, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. Leave us a rating and a comment. It helps us stay on top of the charts so people can find us better. And finally, if you want to join the Crypto 101 media team, reach out to us at reachout@crypto101podcast.com or go to crypto101podcast.com and go to contact and send us an email. We're looking for bloggers, we're looking for audio editors, and we're looking for anyone who wants to join the space, get involved, and, well, shape the future. Now, without further ado, here is Alex Sterk of Ubik, and we'll see you after the show. Alex Sterk, community manager of Ubik, welcome to Crypto 101, sir.
Yeah, awesome. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, man. Thanks for coming on. So what we're going to do today is we're going to do pretty much the Crypto 101 template of going through a little bit about yourself, the history of the project, going through what it's planning to accomplish in the space, how it compares to different competitors, if there are competitors in the market, in the space right now, and how it's going to roll out in the future. And of course, going into your general opinions about the crypto space right now. What do you think, sir?
Oh, yeah, that sounds great. Yeah.
Sir, please tell us a little bit about yourself.
Certainly. So I was born and raised on a farm in southwestern Ontario, Canada, about an hour and a half south of Toronto. Spent most of my time in high school and a little bit of time even in college and afterwards milking cows. And then I got into electrical engineering, specializing in automation. Spent some time with BlackBerry and General Motors before kind of having, I guess, a early life crisis and deciding to go out to the West Coast. Spent some time in Vancouver, where the crypto scene there is very much alive. There's lots of good developers and community members. And I was able to kind of finally get the chance to meet people who are, more knowledgeable than I. So I was feeling less like a crazy person, which is always good to have. But yeah, then I started a little bit of a podcast, Block Talk at the time. Yeah, I did some interviews, got to know lots of people on the online Twitter space, and from there I really got involved with the community of Ubik early on, before it was Ubik. Really, I felt the need to kind of help organize the project and make sure that things were we had kind of an outlook and a goal, and really find our place in the industry. And that's where I've now kind of become the community manager, but also the CEO of one of the development companies on Ubik.
Right on, man. Right on. So when you were milking these cows, where were you?
Down here in Ontario, Canada. Don't like to give the exact location, but I like to say it's the middle of nowhere and a half hour from everywhere. I've even checked it and measured it. It's pretty well central.
Right on. So that's quite a skill set you have. So besides the milking cows, you have electrical engineering. How'd you go through that path, and what took you out of electrical engineering into crypto space and then finding your way into the Ubik community?
Well, the dairy farm, we always had a lot of kind of automation and a lot of new technology rolling through. Like, we've had self-driving tractors for almost 20 years now. So it's always been catching my eye. There's robotic milkers and stuff like that. And that's where I kind of got the pull to go to school for electrical engineering. General Motors, I found a lot of boredom on the night shift waiting for something to break. So I used a lot of that free time to kind of do some research in the crypto space, learn about Bitcoin, and that's really where I kind of got the nuts and bolts of it down, and really saw how there was ways that I could apply not just at the plant that I was working at, but also at the farm. Like, there's a lot of issues with networking in both those environments, and blockchain I think has a lot of capability to kind of improve both those industries.
So wait, okay, you just gave me a mind blow just about a little bit ago. Self-driving tractors, this is a thing?
Oh yeah, because you gotta get those rows of corn like really straight. So you get the tractor track with GPS, and it's got a little motor on the steering wheel to make sure it's always correcting back to that initial kind of line, and even does all the spacing and everything for you. So yeah, your only job then is to make sure you don't fall asleep.
Okay, so can it do turns and everything, and just like do your whole perimeter, or what's the, or is it just straight?
Usually you do the perimeter yourself, and then you do all the turnarounds. But yeah, for the straight lines, that's what was heavily automated. So it's very rudimentary, like not like the Teslas we see today, but it is getting better. And it was kind of, I think, where a lot of the proving ground for the technology was.
Okay, because the first time I saw a self-driving tractor was in the movie Interstellar, and I was just like, dude, it's the future.
Yeah, no, we've had that for a while now. It's amazing. I mean, you still got to have an operator, but there's definitely a lot more, or a lot less driver fatigue, and a lot more efficiency.
So what was it that attracted you to the crypto space? Was it the liberty, the freedom, the down with the Fed, or was it just the decentralization, the tech, the... What was it?
Yeah, the technology was definitely interesting. I mean, from the finance side too. Like, I was making good money as an engineer, and I was just kind of getting sick of every time I went to the bank, they were looking at my balance and saying, "Oh, you want to sit down with our investment advisors?" And it's like, you know what? I'm gonna go through this myself. I'm gonna take a little leap into investments. And after about 4 weeks of trying to get registered on an exchange and buy Bitcoin the proper way, I finally had it. And within a half hour, I was on other sites and investing in other coins. So from that moment, I was just kind of hooked of just like the ease of use and the freedom that you have.
Right on. And what year was that?
This was April 2014.
All right, right on. So you've been holding Bitcoin since 2014.
Oh yeah, I've went through that whole bear market in 2015. Those are the good times.
So is this the bear market of 2018? Is this the worst it's going to get, in your opinion, in your years of experience?
I mean, it could definitely go sideways for a while. We have the halving in 2020 coming up, so like that's going to be another kind of catalyst for upward movement. But I think just with the way the mining economy is going, with big players like Samsung getting involved, we're definitely going to see a big jump in price in the next 6 months to a year. Yeah, like we're going to hit that $1 trillion market cap for Bitcoin alone.
Oh, right on, right on. Well, we're looking forward to it because my arms are weak from holding so many bags. So
yeah, I feel that.
Anyway, well, we won't go into the bags that I'm holding. I think the listeners already heard that enough. Run us through a history lesson of Ubiq. You said it started as a different project before. What was the project before? And what was the evolution?
Yeah, so the original project was called Jumbux, which, I mean, kind of humorous name. But if Bitcoin launched with like an email list, you know, Satoshi kind of put the word out to a bunch of these cryptographers to help them launch this network. Ubiq was originally launched, or Jumbux was originally launched with a chat room. One of the most popular ones back in 2014, it was CoinMarkets. It was back when everyone was on IRC, Telegram wasn't really a thing, and a lot of the coin developers and traders were all in this one room. And yeah, it was a fair launch, no ICO, no pre-mine, so everyone had the ability to mine it. Like, I wasn't even in the chat room at the time, but just in my passings on Twitter, I was able to find out about it, and I had just gotten a new Litecoin miner. I'm like, man, I want to try this out on something other than Litecoin. I gotta get my feet wet. And that's where the project kind of got its footing in. And the first priority was not to list it on an exchange. I was really connecting with that as let's make it more than just something to trade. It actually needs to have some utility. So yeah, there were some community projects, some crypto collectible cards. If I was at my desk, I'd show you them. They're pretty cool. These 5 playing cards that were made of prominent members in the space. The only way you could purchase it was with this currency. So these were the kind of like cool community projects. And that's really what it came down to. It was a good community in the beginning. And I guess it's 2 years ago, almost to the day, we launched a testnet for switching to Ethereum code. We built our own version of the Ethereum code base of the developers and the key members of the community and say, like, how do we really want to advance the currency forward? And we really saw there a lot of utility and a lot of more developments coming along for the Ethereum code base. So we decided to make the our currency into also network fuel, where you can execute smart contracts with it. So that's where we were able to basically build our own version of the Ethereum network with some different parameters, and still with the original fair launch, no ICO, no pre-mine, doing a swap of the old currency to the new.
So basically, you made an Ethereum, but named it something different. What is Ubiq designed to do? And what was the purpose? What was the inspiration of Ubiq?
It was around the same time the DAO hack was going on, and there was a lot of issues with the centralization of Ethereum and just the whole idea of the Ethereum Foundation having, like, not just control over the development, but also having a large control over the currency. Like, that was the main reason I think the DAO got so big, was there was a lot of the pre-mined coins going into it. But that's where we kind of saw there's an opportunity to have, I guess, a more fair Ethereum out there with the immutability intact. And still the same principles, something like Bitcoin, you know, like it's having no ICO and no pre-mine are very important for an open source project.
So basically, it was just a decision of different form of governance.
Yeah. Well, and at the end of the day, like, our community is just full of developers who like to build cool shit. So we were really getting frustrated with trying to build applications on the Bitcoin code base. And we just saw the ease of use of the Ethereum code base and how that standard was going to be being pushed forward. A lot of the open source projects being developed on it. There's a lot more capability there. Like, no offense to Satoshi, but I don't think he was the greatest programmer. Like, I think he had a lot of help, and we're still kind of feeling the ramifications to that code base, where all Bitcoin code does is keep track of Bitcoin. Mm-hmm. If you want to do anything like tokens or some of these other applications, you really got to go into a higher level of complexity, whereas right. Ethereum is built, like, by programmers for programmers.
Right. So tell us about the network. Tell us about what you're trying to accomplish with Ubiq.
So yeah, like, we did a different currency. We have a kind of different community, but like, different philosophy. But part of it too is the technology, where we made some key changes to the protocol. We actually slowed the block time down. We went to 88 seconds, about a minute and a half. Yeah, we also implemented a monetary policy from the beginning. These all help with the mining economy and the decentralization of the network. You have far less what's called uncle blocks, which are essentially just orphan blocks. But since Ethereum has this uncle protocol, they're able to use their block time so much faster. Like, breaking the minute threshold with a block chain, where you start to have a lot of issues with network latency. So they implemented this uncle protocol to deal with that. But part of the problem with that is when you have these adverse network conditions, you get a lot extra inflation from all the uncles. So we didn't really want to mess with the monetary aspect of it too much. So that's where we went with the longer block time, where you're not going to have as many uncles. We're right around 1% to 2% uncle rate.
You mentioned a monetary policy. You said there was a different monetary policy. Can you explain that a little bit? And also, since this is 101, could you go into uncles and orphans and just explain what that is, 101?
Oh, yeah. Sorry if I go too high level. So the monetary policy, so like Bitcoin, there's a monetary policy that was set from the beginning of the network. I think it was like hard-coded and a little bit later on. But the idea that there's going to be 21 million coins and every 4 years, the emission rate halves. So this was the monetary policy of Bitcoin. We implemented basically a set plan from the beginning of the Ubiq network of what the emission rate was going to be. And miners know that's what we're going to stick to. So what we did was we started with 8 Ubiq per block, and every year we're decreasing by 1 until we get to 1 Ubiq per block. And that's where it's going to stay. So we'll have this kind of steady inflation of Ubiqs coming in every block. And part of the reason for that was we've never seen an example of a proof of work network that runs on fees alone. Like, Bitcoin is aiming to do it, and it will probably be the first one to be mainly fee based. But yeah, we aren't looking to beat them to that goal. So that's where we have that kind of constant emission. But it's going to be fairly reasonable inflation. Like, right now, I think it's like 5% inflation, and we're going down to 0.7. So it's going to be, regardless of the scale of the project, it's going to be pretty like the market will be able to tolerate that level of inflation. As for the uncles, so
uncles and orphans.
Uncles and orphans. Okay, so there's with Bitcoin, if two people mine Bitcoin blocks at the same time, the one that the chain continues on, it will be the main chain, but the block that wasn't accepted by the chain is considered an orphan. Mm-hmm. It's left behind, it's forgotten, and
this kind of sounds really sad.
Yeah, but luckily there aren't that many orphans in Bitcoin. Because of the 10-minute block time, the chances of getting an orphan with the latency of the network is very little.
Is there such thing as an orphanage?
Someone just collecting all the orphan blocks? there's a good record of them on all the block explorers. You can usually see orphan blocks there. But like I said, they're not very common on Bitcoin. Because even if you have something like 1 second of latency, like between two miners generating a block, that's still 1 in 600 chance that that's going to happen, because you have the 10 minutes, 600 seconds between blocks. So Ethereum, they implemented what's called the Ghost Protocol. This was something that was suggested to improve Bitcoin early on, where if you give a small reward to the orphan blocks and have them kind of included in the chain, essentially call them an uncle instead of an orphan. But what that allows for is when you do these faster block times, it reduces the amount of centralization, because if you start getting too many orphans, miners have to start organizing with each other and forming more tight-knit kind of coalitions. People will flock to bigger pools rather than the smaller ones, because if you're trying to like solo mine any currency that's proof of work, or even some of the proof of stake ones, if you are solo mining, your latency is going to be a detriment to you. Like you're not going to have as much success as you would with a bigger pool. So rewarding the uncles incentivizes people to still solo mine and not just join the biggest pool, because they're gonna have the better latency, or like they're gonna have better odds. So that's kind of the whole idea of uncles and orphans.
Right on. So are ghosts dead orphans? That's what I'm wondering. So if there's no orphanage, who's taking care of the orphans? And you said there's a ghost port. Man, this is turning really sad. It's a dark podcast. We're going down a really dark path.
Well, the funny thing with the Ethereum's uncle blocks too is, since the block time is so fast, you'll have uncles on top of uncles. So instead of calling them an uncle, they call them cousin blocks and second cousin blocks. It's kind of funny, the terminology. But uncles and orphans generally are not considered a good thing in blockchains. You want to try and avoid them in your network. Luckily there's not too many on Bitcoin or on Ubic. Ethereum has had some issues once the blocks get pretty full. Like when you're sending bigger packets around, there's quite a bit more uncles. You gotta keep an eye out for those uncles, because they're you don't want too many of them.
Thank you for the 101, by the way, on orphans and uncles and cousins and second cousins and ghosts. We appreciate that.
Yeah, no problem.
I guess what I'm really trying to get into as well is that there's a lot of smart contract platforms out there, you know, Ethereum, Ubic, you know, and many other ones. How are you separating yourself from, say, Ethereum, which is, you know, the most popular? It's probably the most developed on. What is your roadmap for the future to, I guess, make the separation to encourage people to develop on your platform opposed to these others? And what are some of the major competition that you have out there? And do you have a plan to either work with them, compete against them, or what have you?
Well, Ethereum, its main innovation was the EVM, the Ethereum Virtual Machine. And this is becoming the de facto standard in smart contracts. Like there's even a protocol layer being built on top of Bitcoin to have an EVM rootstock. So we saw that this is going to be the kind of the standard of smart contracts. There's a lot of these other platforms that are coming out now, and some of them are deviating from the EVM. Some of them are completely new code bases or new opcodes, basically trying to develop an entirely new smart contract system. And part of the problem I see in that is it's not exactly as battle tested as Ethereum is. Like we've seen some issues with the Ethereum code base, mostly because people are actually using it. They're trying new things. They're moving fast. They're sometimes breaking stuff, but they're fixing it. And just like with Bitcoin, there's a couple bumps in the road. That standard is being developed, and it's being more utilized, and it's really getting a lot more of the development education on it. So we saw that with Ubic, and we see that as kind of sticking with that standard as kind of adding to that ecosystem. Because you can deploy the same smart contract on Ethereum as you can with Ubic. The difference being is right now the cost is significantly less. It's like less than 1%. But yeah, so that's where there is some benefit of YUBIC versus Ethereum. Yeah, you want to be able to know that there's all the development tools that you need. So I'll set this aside right now that we don't view ourselves as a competitor to Ethereum. We're more of a complementary network. We're trying to push the same standard. We're working with our own businesses, our own user base. We're educating people on how to use the same system because the user experience is very much the same. And that can be said for Ethereum Classic and a couple of the other EVMs. We want to make sure that there's all the tools that you need. Something like MetaMask, which is like the main tool for interacting with dApps. We have our own version of it called Sparrow, and that's important for anyone who wants to develop a dApp on YUBIC. Even something like MyEther Wallet, you can use YUBIC through MyEther Wallet or MyCrypto, but we also have our own fork of that system, that code base called Pyrus, P-Y-R-U-S. And part of, I think, setting ourselves apart from a lot of the competition is actually having a lot of these tools available, making sure that a lot of the frameworks, even something like Harper wallet support, that was another key reason to stick with a standard like Ethereum, is to be able to implement yourself on hardware wallets. So we're on Ledger and Trezor. And that's where I guess we kind of have a bit more namestay. And also things like token support by exchanges. So say you want to deploy an ERC-20, you don't want to put it on Ethereum because it's too expensive. You maybe want to put it on Ethereum Classic. The thing is, no exchange right now is supporting Ethereum Classic tokens. There's maybe like one or two tokens on that network that are trading on an exchange, but it's very sparsely supported. Where YUBIC, we have token support from two major exchanges. And we actually have about 8 tokens right now that are trading on exchange with value, and a couple more community ones that are more kind of fun tokens that might have value one day. That's where there is a little bit more kind of industry adoption and bullet points for when you're shopping around for what EVM you want to deploy on. Because it's kind of like a choose your own cell phone plan, right? Like you gotta have options, and having a little bit of competition in the EVM space is good too.
And now a word from our sponsor, Eero. Never think about Wi-Fi again. The Eero people set out to make Wi-Fi systems they wish they had in their homes. Single router systems just don't work. It's like light waves. Imagine trying to light your master bedroom from a light bulb in your living room. What you need is a distributed system. With Eero, you can install their second generation Wi-Fi system in your home in just a few minutes. Just simply download the Eero app on your iOS or Android device, and it'll walk you through it. Eero sent my mom a system, and we at our home had a problem. Our Wi-Fi, our main connection, was in the basement. So to get it up in my mom's bedroom or out in the back garden was nearly impossible. I said, "Mom, don't waste time. Set this up and give me a review." She is so happy by the results. My mom is 58. My stepdad is 62. Was it easy for them to set up? They set it up within minutes. And now, in the bedroom, in the back garden, everywhere, they have Wi-Fi. The Eero app lets you manage your network from the palm of your hand, so you know how many devices you're connected to at any given point, as well as the speed of the internet you're getting from your service provider. You know what your other Wi-Fi routers don't do? They don't update, so you can be vulnerable to cyber attacks without even knowing it. Eero updates constantly. Well, if you're a listener to Crypto 101, you have a special offer. Please go to Eero.com, that's Eero.com, and upon checkout, enter Crypto, CRYPTO, for free overnight shipping in the United States or Canada. That's Eero.com, and upon checkout, click overnight shipping and then the promo code Crypto for free shipping. And now a word from our sponsor, Formosa Financial. Financial services for blockchain innovators. Formosa Financial found that the biggest bottleneck for most blockchain innovators is access to banking. They fundraise and innovate in the crypto world, but they operate in the real world. Employee salaries, rent, bills are all in fiat. Almost all blockchain companies can't get a bank account, so everyone is using Band-Aid solutions to manage their funds properly. The solution? Formosa Financial. At Formosa Financial, we've created the ideal financial service platform for all blockchain innovators. First, we've secured reliable banking partnerships that enable us to offer banking services to blockchain innovators. We focused on banking partnerships, licensing, and compliance. Second, we've built a suite of financial services that can help blockchain innovators manage their funds conveniently so they can focus on growing their business. We've built a brokerage account, crypto to fiat trading, and we have risk management services. How can you make sure that $10 million in crypto today is worth $10 million next year so you can operate your business? Well, we have a solution. If you're an innovator or an investor, please check out formosa.financial. That's formosa.financial for more information. Now, back to our show.
You know, in preparation of for this chat with you, I've watched a lot of YouTube videos. I would say a year ago, everybody was saying this is the Ethereum killer. This is the one that's going to, you know, go right against Ethereum and knock them off their platform. I guess everybody's looking for the Ethereum killer. But then a year later, though, everything changed. Like, there's too much competition. There's too much people trying to do the same thing. Then you also just said making your own wallets and protocols and things like that. You know, you don't have to use MetaMask and MyCrypto. You have your own thing, which also kind of gets you more niche and gets you more away from the mainstream, you know, maybe give you less user interaction because you're not right there with the mainstream. I guess I know you don't consider Ethereum a competition, but there is competition out there, and there's a lot of people trying to do the same thing as you guys. What is the roadmap for the next 5 years to make yourself keep being relevant?
I think right now it's just making sure all the tools are ported over. We're working right now with businesses to even utilize the chain, like Cryptopia, a major exchange out of New Zealand. All of their token products are Ubic tokens.
That's where I bought my Sumo coin.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I've been working some orders on there today. So those guys work hard, and they list a lot of really good stuff and a lot of other random stuff, too.
I love the random shit.
Oh, yeah, that's great. But, I think going forward in the future, like, we don't really have, like, a rigid roadmap, mainly because we didn't raise money from anyone. And I think in a lot of cases, that's a benefit because that makes us more adaptable. We can easily pivot to having new features or new focuses. The main one we're working on right now for application size is governance of the platform, where we have a governance token that was airdropped to active Ubic holders. And that's where we see there's a lot of lot of potential for growth in the future of building all these different protocols for these ERC-20 protocols into a single token. So if you're familiar with Aragorn or District 0x, these are both kind of governance platforms, and that's what we're first building utility onto this token. But all these ERC-20 tokens are following the same standard, and you can build the same functionality on basically any of them. So something like a 0x exchange, like a decentralized exchange, we're planning on building that onto the framework of this token. Prediction markets, something like Gnosis or Augur, building that functionality. So really all these protocol tokens can all be hosted by Ubic holders. So we can have all the same functionality as the Ethereum ecosystem, but it's much more cohesive and it's all kind of operated from the same token holders. So it makes the layer two a lot cleaner and a lot better for governance. So that's kind of our roadmap right now of just getting the governance side rolling a bit further. We're going to have bounties and having it operate more like an open source project, because we do actually have a development fund from some of the ICOs that we did help develop on the project on the platform. They've contributed some Bitcoin to a multi-sig, where now we have about 20 Bitcoins that we can put towards bounties to incentivize developers to come and build on the platform. So that's really where I see a lot of our growth potential or our plan for the future is incentivizing developers to just port over their protocols or develop new things that are exciting and try and claim a bounty with it.
Assume that you would agree with this statement then. It is better to build your own than to partner and have synergies with different companies.
Having a lot of partners or having all these different tokens that all do different things. I think it's kind of fractaling the community a little bit. Like, I think it could be seamless one day, but right now it just looks like it's going to be a bit of a cluster of like, oh, I want to do this on the network. I got to buy this token, or I got to transfer and buy this other network token in order to, you know, accomplish a couple really common tasks on the Ethereum platform. So making it a little more cohesive is, I think, going to be in our benefit.
How many people do you have working with YUBIC right now?
So, yeah, like right now, it's a very tough question to answer how many developers we have, because it's a very fluid project where there isn't really a set payroll for a lot of the people working on it. But we have about four people that are considered core devs, and then another four or five that are kind of part-time guys that are just developing things. Like we have this awesome guy in the Netherlands, Eric, who has been developing a block explorer and a mining pool. And yeah, he's been doing a lot of really great work. One of our newest core devs, Aldo, he's based out of Barcelona. He just kind of showed up one day and was like, I like what you guys are doing. I want to really build out an open source version of Infura for the YUBIC network. And he's really been helping with the core protocol level stuff too. So this is the kind of beauty of doing a project with a fair launch and no ICO, is that people can kind of come out of the woodwork and feel like they're contributing equally to the project.
Are they getting paid?
In a lot of cases, no. But right now, the bounty system is rolling up. And with the YUBIC technologies, we're kind of doing a sponsorship of some of the developers that are working in the space. But a lot of the guys are working full-time at other companies. Like Aldo just got a job with MyEtherWallet, so he's kind of working on YUBIC still as a passion project. And a lot of the stuff he's working on with MyEtherWallet ports over to YUBIC quite nicely. And then... Even our core protocol dev, Julian, he works as a code auditor at Bittrex. So he got a full-time gig there, but he still finds some time to do some programming for us. But yeah, the YUBIC development company, YUBIC Technologies, is where there's a little bit more kind of economics to that play, people on the payroll. And that's something we're gearing up a bit more now with some of the enterprise projects we're working on.
I've seen this in the past, and I want your opinion on this, is that I've talked to, interviewed, had on the show, and know personally a lot of different coins, communities, companies, projects that people are just, you know, volunteer-based. They don't get paid. You didn't raise money. There isn't a structure in place to hire the people to continue development. People get busy. They do take full-time jobs somewhere, and then... well, they just kind of start prioritizing their life different ways. The project stalls, things don't get released on time, the community gets frustrated, the market cap goes down. How do you plan to, I mean, and this isn't something new that has happened in this space, this happens all the time. With the current structure, how do you plan to not have that happen?
Well, I think that's where our governance system comes in with the bounties. Like having someone delegated to develop a project even before they get paid, but like the money sitting there waiting for them to finish, like that's a big incentivization for them. And I think a part of it too, like I said, we don't really have a roadmap. We're a very fluid project that way. We usually just like to report on what we've done rather than hype on what we're doing. And that's been working pretty well for us. Just making sure that we're able to, you know, not over promise, but definitely over deliver. So that's where there's definitely always improvement that can be made. But I think as a project, like the formal bounty system is where we can see a lot more throughput and a lot more kind of responsibility put on these developers and projects.
You're full time with this project?
Oh, yeah. I've been full-time crypto since May last year.
Oh, right on. Cool, man. Cool. Yeah. So how do you get paid?
Right now, it's a bit of a money sink for me, so if anything. I've been funding a lot of the project myself in terms of like getting swag developed or going to conferences. I'm usually paying out of pocket for it. But that's part of the development company. Like that's where we have YUBIC the project or YUBIC the network, and then YUBIC Technologies is a company, like a for-profit company. And you can kind of think of us like the first Bitcoin company. It's that's where consulting is pretty good income. And then the development work, like I said, the enterprise projects are mm-hmm. where we see there's a lot more potential to get income. There's always ways that you can be making good money in the space if you're in it long enough.
Cool. Is there anything else you want to touch on UBIC before we go into general questions?
Yeah, I guess if you have any UBIC holders out there, or if you have people who want to interact with a smart contract for the first time, we're still doing airdrops of our governance token. The next one will be, I think, in 2 months. What you need to do, it's not a traditional airdrop where you just have money in your account and you're good to go. You need to actually interact with a smart contract to register your address to say, I am an active user. Here's my UBIC address. And then on the snapshot date, any UBIC that's in your account, you'll be credited some Escher tokens. That's where we have some more votes coming out too for it, and the bounty system will utilize it. So it's kind of an easy way to play around with smart contracts and really understand how the nuts and bolts of it work.
Right on. We said at the beginning of this podcast that Samsung, big companies are going to start getting into mining. You think we are going to see, let me rephrase that, $1 trillion Bitcoin market cap. Oh, we could only wish.
Oh yeah, 58 grand, $300 is the price I'm predicting for Bitcoin in the next kind of run up. I think next 6 months to a year we're going to see that.
You think
so? And that makes you. Yeah, I'm pretty confident in it. I mean, just looking at the mining economy side of things, I'm not sure if there's any miners, people who still mine Bitcoin as a hobby, but if you pay attention to the Bitcoin difficulty, the last adjustment. I guess the second last one, the difficulty actually went down. And that's a really bullish sign to me, because that means that miners were not being plugged in. We're kind of reaching a bit more of an equilibrium. So a lot of the people who are mining Bitcoin are kind of losing their shirt because they're mining at a loss. So there was even a couple news reports of some of the cloud mining providers have invalidated their contracts. Yep. The Kodak mining scam got busted. These are all really bullish indicators, and it's a good sign in a bear market that the filth is being fleshed out. And there's a lot of filth to be fleshed out, but that's a pretty good indication, at least on the Bitcoin side.
So you don't think we're going to have to wait until about 6 months to a year after that next halving?
It's tough to say. Like, I don't want to.
Of course, this isn't financial advice. You're not a financial advisor, yada, yada, yada. The opinions, opinions, man. we all have our fingers to the breeze. We have no clue where the wind's coming from.
Well, and with Bitcoin, it's not a matter of if, it's a matter of when. So mm-hmm. It's like, if you're patient enough, Bitcoin is a 2-year investment. It's the best returns out there. Like, there's only like 3 days that you could have lost money looking at it as a 2-day or 2-year investment. So yeah, if you got a little money to spare, then it's like, okay, yeah, throw it in Bitcoin for the 2 years and you'll have some pretty good returns. The question, I think, with this last run up, and when the next one happens, is it going to be kind of like another 2015 scenario where we really got to do some long sideways and flush out a lot of the a lot of the filth in the space, or is it kind of the one of two legs? Like, we're not finished repricing for this next kind of shift, because we saw that with the 2014 bubble. That was actually the second leg of that year. So I don't know. It seems like it's going to be a pretty bullish November, but there's lots of factors at play. Like, if we see this ETF pass, it's a pretty bullish demand.
ETF are we talking about here? I think there's a couple going on. There's a cargo. There's a Canadian.
I think it's any ETF that's actually backed by Bitcoin, not based on the futures. So there are a couple Canadian ones. It's a little bit more small time. I think one of the ones, like the Winklevoss ones, I know it got denied, but it's kind of like, it's the main one. I think they have the most liquidity to supply an ETF, whereas any of the these other ones, I'd be really worried about their ability to meet demand. I mean, it will cause a lot of short-term demand in the price, but there'll be a lot of equilibrium that will have to come about after that. The other side of it too is if one of these ETFs get passed, then a whole bunch of them are going to come pouring through. So it's kind of like, which one's going to be the first one? If we a bunch of concerns, the next Mt. Gox will be. The next Mt. Gox will be one of these ETFs getting hacked.
Yeah, I guess you know what we're all looking are not looking forward to is a monster sideways like the 2015, 16, 17, just sitting there with nothing to do, especially as a podcaster. I want some shit to talk about.
That's when I really enjoyed podcasting. It was my favorite time in the space because that's when projects are really buckling down. You get a developer on who you can tell he's been like coding his ass off because like there's really nothing else to do with trading or anything. So those are the times like I said at the beginning, it's like 2015 was a good time for me. As boring as it is for the sideways, like that's when a lot of rubber is meeting the road and things are getting done. Like when we're going parabolic upwards, I think everyone gets distracted and not much gets accomplished.
They do. There is a silver linings to any dark cloud there, the parabolic cloud or the sideways cloud. Who do you look up to in the crypto space? And I just want to frame this for a second. If you were like on Twitter and this person was tweeting, or if this person was writing a blog on Medium or Steemit, if this person, you know, happened to be on CNN, CNBC, or some kind of, you know, TV show to talk about whatever, you would be tuned in. Who is this person?
I'm quite fond of Bill Sahara and Richie Lai from the Bittrex team. Bittrex in general is like one of my favorite projects in the space, just because it's one of those engineering teams first. Like they just set out to try and build the best exchange possible, and then it was like April last year that they were just maxing out the last of their server credits and only still had 4 employees, and we were just starting to see a lot of exchanges kind of crumbling under the sheer volume that they were processing. But these guys had built a scale; they were built and ready. Like, yeah, it's not so much a business first focus, but a technology first focus. So, those are the type of people I usually like to hear speak about the industry.
What do you think about the Bittrex loss of market share and their redesign? I guess those are two totally opposite questions, but
I don't think they've lost too much market share. I think there's a lot of fake volume floating around.
You think
like,
so?
I think. Oh yeah, like if you want to find the truest volume in the space, you look at something like Bittrex, because like there are no fee breaks.
Last year, Bittrex was number one. It was probably almost hitting a billion 24-hour volume. Now it's mostly Chinese exchanges hit BTC. Binance and what have you. Bittrex isn't even on the top 40 anymore. So you think that's actually more realistic volume?
Yeah. I think some of these other ones, I question some of the numbers they're putting out. I don't want to speak too ill of Binance because it would always be great to have a listing there. But it still is questionable of how much volume could be there. And the other thing too is the fee break that they give with their Binance token allows for more trading for less cost. So it's like how much money is being spent on fees. It's very consistent on Bittrex, and that makes it a pretty good gauge for the space. So I think that's where you see a lot more kind of institutional traders or institutional investors kind of looking to fill their altcoin bags, whereas Binance can be a little, worrisome sometimes. I mean, nothing to knock Malta, but I don't put a big bag there because it's if their whole concept is to move fast and shake trees, it's kind of hard to put your money in their pocket to help them do it.
And what about the Bittrex redesign? Good move or bad move?
I love the night theme. I mean, like the white was always searing my eyes late at night when I was trying to
that is true.
Do some late night trading. But I think it was very welcome. It was kind of like the first major step of like the improving the UX. It definitely has more work to do. I mean, I know guys that work there that aren't even happy with it. So it's it's something that they're working on. And I think the API is always a good option too. Like I do a lot of trading through Coinigy as well. So like you just plug in your APIs into there and you get the same user experience for every exchange.
Crypto 101 has positioned itself to be one of the first stops in the space. If you're coming into the space and you're Googling, you're saying, hey, cryptocurrency 101, you know, whatever, we might pop up. So it's very possible if somebody's hopping in because, you know, Bitcoin went down a little bit and they were going to buy their first Bitcoin, they might hear this episode as their first step into the space. What would you want this noob to know about getting into the space?
Trust no one, but find someone you can trust.
All right, Agent Fox Mulder.
No, that was advice that I got from a friend that I met a while back. But I think it's like you really got to go beyond just the exchange, because like to buy a Bitcoin on Coinbase is only one part of the process. To withdraw it is the other side of it. And we're very fortunate now that with things like hardware wallets, it's much easier to be secure but still have the level of convenience. So yeah, if you can manage to at least do one withdrawal, it doesn't have to be much, but like understand like the real side of the technology, the freedom that comes with having your own money and your own address. And I mean, if you can't afford a hardware wallet, you can play around with the paper ones too. That's what I did early on.
Right on, man. Right on. Cool. Alex, before I ask this last question, I want to say thank you very much for the 45 minutes of your time using your data on your phone to come on this show. And I guess the last question is, what three songs would you like to put on the Crypto 101 Spotify playlist?
Oh, geez. I got a long list. For having me, and you know, it's not too big a deal with putting a little bit more points on the data bill. I'm just trying to expense it to the company. I think for good songs, let me go to my Shazam here, because I heard some good ones the other day.
Shazam. All
right. I want to hear some Dirty Laundry by Don Henley.
Okay.
Let's see. There's Down Under by Men at Work. That's always a fun one.
That's always already on the playlist. Already twice on there.
Oh, man. What about What's Up by Four Non-Blondes? How about that?
Nope. Don't have that one.
Okay, cool. And then Go All the Way by The Raspberries.
You got it, man. Alex.
That's what crypto's going to do. It's going to go all the way.
Hopefully all the way to that 1 trillion that you're talking about, 58,300.
Oh, yeah.
I won't be holding bags.
No. You'll be spending them, I'm sure.
If I'm smart this time, if I was smart last time, I would have been spending them last time.
It's all good, man. It happens. It goes around, comes around.
Right. Alex Sturk of Ubik, thank you very much for coming on Crypto 101.
Once again, thanks for having me. It was a great time.
All right, brother. Thank you very much for listening to this episode of Crypto 101. Alex, if you're listening, thank you very much for coming on the show. Please, after you're done listening to this, go to our YouTube channel, Crypto 101 with Matthew Aaron, where you can hear my roundup and opinions on this project. In the next episodes of Crypto 101, we are sitting down with the listeners, where we ask just people in the community, what are they holding, how they got into crypto, what they're thinking of the space, the bear market these days, because it's the average consumers, it's us, that actually make the space important. So I'm excited to sit down with almost a half dozen listeners in these next coming episodes. We're going to sprinkle them around, so a couple here, a couple there, and maybe we'll do a LISC 101 in between. And before we go, like always, apogeecrypto.com, apogeecrypto.com, the best place to check your real-time prices, cryptonews.com for your news, and we will see you in the next episodes of Crypto 101.
For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on unlimited welcome for $45 per month with AutoPay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Columbus Verizon store by April 2nd to save. $20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on unlimited welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/PODKATZ13. Just go to Indeed.com/PODKATZ13 right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.